Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, the author of How to Be a Grown-Up and The Sisterhood. My debut novel, Insatiable, is coming in February, and there's a limited signed edition available to pre-order from Waterstones for Your Book listeners. Also, as you know, on this podcast, we love our indie bookshops. If you'd like to pre-order from your local, it would make my day. I'm going to try an experiment. If you ask your favourite local bookshop to order you a copy and then ask them to tweet at YBook to tell me, I will try to send you something special to go with your book. It might be a cover coordinating chocolate orange, unless the next 2020 British panic purchase is the chocolate orange. Also, I know that a lot of you have been enjoying producer Dale's very, very funny Twitter haikus. If you're not familiar, his Twitter handle is PG Woodhouse Themed. He's at Monty Bodkin. You will love his book, Painfully British Haikus. And it's even funnier when you buy it from lovely independent bookshops. Now, all our guests are favourites of mine, but oh, this is one of my favourite favourites. Today we have the prolific writer Louise O'Neill, a beacon of fierceness, funniness and feminism. Her latest book, After the Silence, is her best book to date, and that's saying something, according to none other than Marion Keyes. It's about an unsolved murder. It's a super smart thriller with real humanity and depth at its heart. We talked about Louise's life in New York, fairies, ghosts and Catholics, why everyone in the world needs to read Belinda McCowan, and why little Louise got into trouble for being a book addict. We've had an interesting time the last 6 months. Have your reading habits changed at all? Did you find that you were reaching for comfort reads or radically different things about plagues?
That's interesting. You know, it was funny when it first happened, you know, like when lockdown was first called in March, or I suppose really when the severity of the situation became pretty clear, I felt as if my brain was broken. And I think that's the only way that I can describe it. You know, I couldn't write. I couldn't watch television. You know, I think everyone kept recommending that I watch, you know, Tiger King. And I noticed that I would manage to sort of focus for about like 10 minutes and then I would have to turn it off. And for me, I think most unusually, I really struggled to read. And I think that if you're someone who has always loved reading, who has always turned to books, you know, for comfort and for escape and for, for solace, I think it was the first time in my entire life where I hadn't been able to do that. So I think there was about a month where I just didn't read anything. And then actually what was really helpful was that I put something on my Instagram stories where I was asking people for their recommendations of like their favorite romantic, sexy novels. And some of the like responses were so funny. Like I was like, I want a hot book. I want hot sex. I want to be like really horny after reading this. And someone recommended Jane Eyre. I was like, maybe not for me. Like, maybe not quite what I'm... I think I need something a bit more explicit here.
Hell of an insight into that person, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, it really broke it. Because I think that I read about three or four kind of in a row. And, you know, I think then, because maybe they weren't too taxing and because it felt really just enjoyable, and I wasn't putting, I don't know, not that I was putting pressure on myself, but I was really just saying, I'm just doing this for fun. And that, I think, broke the reading slump, because as soon as I started to, because it's like anything, you know, as soon as I started to read, I was like, oh, I'm able to do this again, you know.
But I love how you intuited that that was what would break your duck. Like, horn, I need horn. So tell me about these sexy books.
I don't know. I mean, I think that there's definitely been times in my life where, like, I know when I studied English at university, that was actually quite an interesting experience as well, because that was maybe the first time that I felt quite resistant towards reading in a way, because it felt as if it was very much tied up in academia, and having to analyze the book in a certain way rather than just reading for enjoyment. And actually what I found helped me then, which is so funny looking back, was I started rereading like old Sweet Valley Highs, you know, like which are like the worst books that have ever been written. But I think, again, it's that sense of a book that is, and when I say not taxing, I think that in a way it's sort of similar that when I was a student, you know, you're reading a book and analysing it. And I think sometimes as a writer, you're reading a book and you're sort of subconsciously analysing how the writer has done this, or the way that they've structured the book, or the way that they've achieved something, or, you know, so I think it's sometimes it maybe isn't quite as relaxing as the way that when you read a book, the way I read a book when I was a child was just this complete and utter absorption, you know, that my parents would be saying, Louise, and like I genuinely just wouldn't be able to hear them. And I actually think it's quite rare now, particularly, I suppose, there's so many things that are, you know, demanding our attention, but, you know, definitely smartphones, I think, are probably the worst culprit there. It's a little bit more rare to have that complete and utter just engrossed in a book that you can block out the outside world.
So can you remember what some of those books were? Like, what books where you nearly injured yourself because you couldn't just come out and look up, or books where you just have no idea what was happening at that point in your life because you were in there?
Well, I would say Enid Blyton was a big one. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't really remember. I mean, obviously I don't remember, but I was asking my mother recently, like, what picture books did I like? And, you know, she couldn't seem to remember exactly, but I know by the time I was a child, like Enid Blyton, whether that was the boarding school stories, and I preferred St. Clair's, or whether it was like the mysteries and I preferred Secret Seven. And I know those are two actually quite controversial opinions, because
they really are St. Clair's? What?
Yeah, I know.
Show you're working. Sell it to me.
Yeah, so I think those were the books that I was really drawn to. And I loved like the magic faraway tree. Like, I loved this idea of this magical tree in the middle of the forest, and that there would, every time you climbed it, that there would be this completely different land at the top. And I used to walk to school, and I would read my book while I was walking to school. So I have no idea how I wasn't in like a major car accident. It's a miracle that I'm alive. And I remember my mother, my teacher called her once, and my parents were so shocked because, you know, I think they'd never been called to the school with my older sister, and they couldn't imagine, you know, what the teacher would want to say to them. So they went up, and the teacher said, look, you know, we have to talk about Louise. All she does is read. She reads at lunchtime rather than playing with the other children. When I'm teaching her, she's under the desk reading while we're supposed to be doing maths. And like, my parents would have said, even at nighttime, you know, it was like when they turn off the light, I'd ask for them to leave like a crack of the door open, because I said I was scared of the dark, but it was really so that I could sneak in and like read my book in this like 2-inch chink of light, like moving the book up and down. And when we were bold, like when we were naughty, our punishment would be that we couldn't read for like 2 weeks, which is so funny because I think most parents are really trying to encourage their children to read more. And my parents were like, Jesus, these two nerds we have here, don't know what we're going to do with them.
I love that obviously reading during maths is very understandable, but also that playing with the other children, no thank you. I've got all the friends I need right here.
I know.
I still have a really sharp and sort of visceral memory of the end of the magic faraway tree and the damage that is done to the roots of the tree and the peril they're in and the pure, pure grief and fear. I felt like being just absolutely inconsolable, having no, and even though I knew it wasn't real, still really felt utterly overwhelmed. I think that was one of the first times I remember that there could be a story with that much peril in it and there might not be a happy ending.
You know, it's funny there when you said I knew it wasn't real, because I think there was a part of me that maybe, like, I really believed in magic. And I do think it's partly maybe having grown up Catholic, where you're sort of encouraged to believe in a kind of magic, you know, in transubstantiation every Sunday, you know, that the host is being transformed into the body of Christ and all of these things, and that Jesus, you know, came back from the dead. And so I think there was a part of me, and as well, I suppose, like a lot of, you know, Irish mythology, where my parents wouldn't have necessarily been into that, but, like, you know, my grandparents owned a farm, and there would have been a fairy fort on the farm, and, you know, my granddad would have been very much like, you can't knock this down or disturb this, because, and I don't even think they really believed in it, but I think there was just this sense of better to be careful, do you know? So I think because of all of those things, I think there was a part of me that really did believe that this was real and did believe in magic and believed in fairies. And, you know, it's interesting even as an adult, because I'm quite drawn to a lot of, like, New Age philosophy. And you know, a lot of that is angels and being in touch with the universe and this, you know, ability to manifest, you know, a certain, and in a way, I think it's a part of me that just wants to still believe in the magic that I read, you know, in books like The Magic Faraway Tree.
That makes a lot of sense. And I am right with you on, you know, I grew up in England, but in a very practicing Catholic family. And you go and you hear there was a Latin mass that we go to every Sunday.
Oh, wow, Latin.
When you're hearing those words, and obviously, you know, when you're a reader and you're sort of precocious enough to want to read or understand, and there's a bit of a just, you know, get on with it. And you can, I suppose, figure out little bits of Latin if you know enough of the English. But still, yeah, there's so much in the world that is presented to you that makes no sense and does seem magical. And then you throw yourself into enough of those universes. Joyce Lancaster Brisley, I think, who wrote the Millie Molly Mandy books, she wrote a story, but it's, I think, for slightly older readers, or it's a slightly older girl, and it's about a young girl who, I think, goes to live with her godmother. And there's this scene at the beginning where she's shown to her bedroom and it's some kind of fairy bower. And in my memory, as like a washstand comes up from the ground, and it's made of, you know, moss and marble and sunlight and birch, and I don't know, but things like that, I was really like, well, if I wished hard enough, I could have,
yes,
one of those.
Yes. And that was the thing, was like, I suppose that sense of, like, if I really believe in this enough. And honestly, in a way, like, it's a terrible thing to sell a child, in the same way that I suppose you could argue that a lot of things like The Secret, you know, and things like that are actually quite dangerous things to sell adults, because I think it is that sense of, we all want to feel as if we have control over our lives. And actually, I think that if this year has been anything, it has been a uncomfortable but maybe necessary lesson in surrender, and in just realizing that I can't control everything, and that I have to let go of a lot of that, and just, I don't know, kind of give in to what's happening.
I think you're right. I was just thinking as well, it's weird how often The Secret comes up on this podcast, but when I decided I wanted to start a book podcast, I was not prepared for that, but I have read it and I know it's nonsense, and yet.
Actually, what I find really, I read a really interesting article about it recently, where they were talking about how that The Secret, they were really just saying it's almost at the root of America's ills right now, because of this idea of, I suppose, that you shouldn't care about other people's problems because it's about focusing on the good and ignoring the negative. And I think, I suppose, so much of that is tied up in the idea of the American dream. So that if you're not wealthy, if you're not in a loving relationship, if you're not, you know, at your perfect weight or perfect health, that, I suppose, there's almost like a sense of blame rather than looking at, you know, institutionalized racism or the way in which, you know, systemic racism or the way in which, I suppose, society is structured to benefit the privileged. And it's just really fascinating, I suppose, to see how something like The Secret might have almost played into a Trumpian society. It was quite it was quite unnerving, actually.
One of the things I was thinking about was how overwhelmingly white my bookshelves have been and how I've been making a real effort to address that and change it and read a much sort of wider variety of authors, and how that has led me to some books that have will stay with me forever and books that have been, you know, a really wonderful thing to happen in a terrible year. Have you been at any point decided that you wanted to read differently and then discovered something really exciting?
I think that's such a great question. And you know, it's interesting because I think that I would say maybe 10 years ago, I probably made quite a conscious decision that I was going to read more female writers. And you know, this is often something that when you say, people can get very annoyed about it. And when I say people, I mean men. they're people too, Daisy. I think a lot of it is, you know, this idea of, well, you know, you shouldn't just choose a book because of the gender of the author, and, you know, I suppose death to the author, you know, that theory. But I think the problem is that if you've gone through a traditional education system, if you look at like the literary canon, like that's very much weighted in favor of white straight men. So I think that it was almost like a process of unlearning in a way. And I think particularly as a woman, when you realize, I suppose, how much there's a lot of internalized misogyny, where that often to say that you enjoy reading a female author, you know, who writes primarily about, you know, issues that impact women and women's lives, that is sort of dismissed. And actually, I can think of a perfect example. I was doing a Jane Austen module in my final year at university, and it was a room full of women. I think there was maybe one guy there, and the teacher was male. And he spoke about that he had been invited to talk on this, I think he said it was ITV, but I can't remember now. Like, it was a television program anyway, where they talked about Jane Austen and her legacy. And then they were, I think there was a panel, and they were asked to read contemporary female authors, and I suppose to give their judgment on who they thought was the rightful heir to Jane Austen. And he said, oh, you know, I thought most of them were kind of rubbish. And then he said, but one of them I thought was very good. And he said, still makes me laugh. He was like, I'm not sure if any of you have heard of her. It's Marion Keyes.
The entire room
just kind of exploded. I think like one person at the back said, oh, I love Marion Keyes. And then everybody else was like, yeah, no, I love Marion Keyes too. But I think it was almost like we were embarrassed to say, you know, like I think that we nearly had to have been given permission. And I think so much of that is internalized misogyny, that, you know, what we think is important, you know, is men talking about men's issues. And I think that, you know, like for so long, if you looked at, you know, let's say the books that won the major prizes, most of the time it was male authors, and if female authors won, like the statistics showed that they tended to have male protagonists. So I think for me, it was like this process of like unlearning and wanting to center women and women's voices, and to kind of learn to not be ashamed about that. I think then over the last number of years, probably like the last 3 or 4 years, I think that it was more of a sense of, okay, well, now I need to be reading more authors of color. Now I need to make sure that I am reading, you know, books by queer authors. And it's been really wonderful, actually, because I think that, you know, I'm off Twitter. I just couldn't bear the negative, you know, just it was such a toxic environment. You know, I think one of the things that I really loved about Twitter was this sense of, you know, I am a white middle class woman who was brought up in a very small town in West Cork, surrounded by people who looked exactly the same as I do. And I think that it was really wonderful. I suppose that was what I thought was so brilliant about Twitter at the beginning, was I think this exposure to other people's voices and other people's experience. And I learned so much about race and gender and sexuality and fat shaming and body positivity. And I think just ideas that I just wouldn't have stumbled across, you know, living in quite, you know, a small... Particularly, I mean, now it's different because the internet makes those ideas so much easier to disseminate. And I think that in a way, like, that's what reading is offering me now in an even more immersive way. Because, you know, I think when you're reading a book, you're devoting, I don't know, 5-6 hours or whatever, however long the book is, to this character, to this world.
There are two things there, aren't there? Because I was thinking, I just love this idea. Have you heard of this little known writer called Marion?
Yeah.
I don't suppose you girls would. And how I felt so seen by those books in a way that, you know, nothing had to. And it's this idea they were sort of for adults, because I guess I was, you know, a teen or a preteen, I think, when I first found them. But they felt more for me than anything I'd known. And it was sort of the comfort of them and the being uplifted. And I think in any book where you have all of these people living very, very, very different lives, what I love about books and made up characters and people being flawed and making mistakes and sometimes being unkind and just, you know, being complex, you don't see any of that on Twitter. Twitter is the yes. worst at the moment, certainly. There's no humanity there. There's no dimension.
I mean, especially about social media, like, it does not offer any sort of ability, I think, to be nuanced. And I think actually that's where, you know, when you were asking about, let's say, books by people who are very different to me and how that has broadened my experience, I actually think what has been quite interesting is that, you know, as a child, we read Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, you know, in school. And I think, you know, which is set in Mississippi, I think it's in the 1960s or 1950s, 1940s. I don't know. It's a long time since I read it. But, you know, I think what was interesting about that is that, you know, it's very like I remember being so horrified and shocked at this, you know, like how could people be so racist and how could they treat other human beings with like such a lack of respect. And actually I think that as an adult, what has been really interesting is reading, let's say, a book like Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, or Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid, where actually the racism isn't, you know, the KKK or people using the N-word, you know, because I think that's so easy as a white person to say, well, I would never do that. Whereas actually, I think the experience of reading a book, those kind of books, which have these depictions of, you know, the nice white yeah. person, you know, who's yeah. really ultimately quite clueless. Like, there's such a level of discomfort actually reading that, because you feel, it's like, I remember sometimes some of the scenes, particularly in Such a Fun Age with Alex, I just would have a full body cringe. And I think it's quite confronting, actually. But I think really important to understand, I suppose, that so often that it's the microaggressions or the unintentional, I suppose, off-the-cuff comments that you might make that actually can cause as well.
It was so brilliantly captured, and just so, like, got thinking about it now, and that, like, oh, I can, again, it's that, you know, oh, I feel really nice when I recognise myself in a Marion Keyes book, but I see myself in Kylie Reid's novel, and that feels horrible.
And actually, you know, again, the internet has been really useful for something like that, because even with something like the film Green Book, and I remember, like, seeing the trailer for it and going, God, this looks amazing, and then seeing a lot of commentary around it from people of colour and from black people, I think really explaining the issues that they found with it. And I thought, oh, this is really helpful, actually, to, I suppose, because I think as a white person, you're so used to your perspective and your point of view being centred all the time. And I think it's really important to have that kind of removed. And I think that, you know, and that's why I suppose reading is such a wonderful way of doing that, because then you're not seeing the world through your perspective. Actually, you're seeing a reflection of yourself as seen through the eyes of a person of colour. And that's not the most comfortable thing, but I think it's really necessary.
I have just read Any Human Heart by William Boyd, which is interesting in terms of that sort of very, very male narrative. And I loved it. I truly loved it. I was thinking about the way that women show up in that book and how much paid sex there is and how normalised that is. And I suppose that's a great example of a character who is so lovable and hateable.
Do you think, though, and this is such a an old, quite kind of boring question at this point, but I'm going to say it anyway. I you know, even as you were talking, I was thinking, yes, but it's a male character. And, you know, and I think that we allow them to be flawed in ways that we don't with women. And it's funny, because after Almost Love, which was my last adult novel before the current one, you know, there was so just all I was answering in interviews was about the unlikable female character, that I was so bored of it by the end that I said, I am going to set out now and I'm going to make, you know, she's going to be complicated, but she's going to be likable. I can't go through this again. And it's been interesting because I have had a few comments about the main character in After the Silence. People saying, oh, I was very frustrated with her. I didn't understand why she stayed with Henry. And I was actually so shocked by it, because obviously there's a theme of domestic violence in the book. And I think it just really highlights, I don't know, the double standard that I have for men and women, both in fiction and in real life, that even in a situation like this, where you have someone who is clearly in a controlling relationship, that people weren't commenting going, God, he's a bit of a dick, that it was, well, why doesn't she leave? And it was just such an eerie echoing of the language people use around real life victims of domestic violence. And I do think, I suppose, that men, both in life and in fiction, are allowed to be the anti-hero in ways that women aren't.
I think you're right. And I think in a weird way, it comes back to The Secret, where we want people to have agency, but the narrative that this is entirely your responsibility and your fault is a really, really dangerous one. And I think as well, it's interesting when we talk about this idea that now, the strong woman, it's very fashionable to be a strong woman, and how a lot of the time when we say that, we are thinking about strength in a sort of a toxic masculine way. I think I've talked about this in the podcast before, but I don't know if you know that book, Tender by Belinda McCowan.
Oh my God. Yes. I have such a good story about that book.
Actually. Oh, brilliant.
You can go first.
But that she is throughout doing something that you know is doomed, you know, having a bad affair with someone who will never, ever love her as she wants and deserves to be loved. And she does become quite irritating and frustrating. And you do feel a bit like, come on, have some self-respect. But she still remains someone that I liked and loved and warmed to and cared about. And I wanted her to be okay. And I understood why she was doing all of those stupid things.
And it's, I think that we're more able to cope, I think, with people's complexity in real life, I think, because we can understand that no one's perfect and that people, but I think sometimes in fiction, people want female characters in particular to be slightly flattened out and the edges to kind of be smoothed down. And I think with Tender, was it Kate? Was Kate the main character's name? I can't think now. Because I remember I read it in Italy and I was there by myself for a month in 2015. And I read it on the steps of some Duomo and I just absolutely adored it. And actually, I think it was really interesting to see a lot of the reviews or a lot of the reaction to it was so focused on the idea that the main character was unlikable. But I absolutely adore Belinda McKeown's work. And actually, the story that I had was about her first novel, which is called Solace, not Tender. But so when I was working in New York, I was working at Elle Magazine. And I was working in the fashion department, and when you would, it was kind of almost like a square, and you'd walk around it, and then there was the department that was obviously doing the literary reviews, and there would just be, it was the first time I'd ever seen a proof. I had no idea what a proof was before that point, you know. And so it was the first time they used to have stacks of them, and you could take them, And I was the only person, and I'm not joking, I was literally the only person. I would go home with like stacks of them under my arms, and I didn't have a smartphone. So, you know, and it was like a 45 commute on the subway. So I used to just read constantly. And I found Belinda's, the proof copy of Solace in just on the thing. And I remember like on the stack, and I brought it home and I read it, and I absolutely, like, I fell in love with it. And I found this old email this year, actually. I found this old email that I had written to my boyfriend at the time, just saying, I found this book by this Irish author, and she went to Trinity, which is where I went. And you know, I said, she's living in New York now. And I said, this book is so incredible. And I said, I just think, you know, I really want to write, but I don't think I'll ever be able to create something as good as this. And it was just because Belinda is someone that I'm friends with now.
Oh, wow.
So it was just so funny. Oh, wow. Yeah, just to see, you know, like, she, I think she had won the Newcomer of the Year that same year. And then I ended up winning it like maybe 3 or 4 years later. And it was just this really interesting portal into this other time where I had such desires to write, and that I was looking at this author who was a, you know, a young Irish woman, and feeling envious, you know, and thinking, God, I really wish that I could do that, and just being so blown away by that book, because, you know, it's set on an Irish farm. My mother's parents, who I was very close to, we would have spent every weekend and sort of most of the summer holidays with them, had a farm. So it was just such a familiar setting, and people, and the relationships that were depicted. And I suppose as well, there was a power in reading that and thinking, you know, in New York, and thinking there was value in my own experiences. And I think sometimes as a human being, that's why reading is so powerful, because we all, often we can feel so alone. And I think that when you read a book and you see a thought that you've had, or an experience, or just echoed in the pages, there is this sense of, oh, I'm not alone, you know, or of being seen in a way that I think is so healing, actually.
And I love that that happened, and you were there. I'm assuming their office is sort of somewhere in Manhattan.
It was the Time and Life building. So it was, I think we were on the 52nd floor. The Lehman Brothers, like, offices, empty offices were sort of below us. And so, yeah, I think it was a very surreal moment to have picked up this book, because there were worlds apart, you know, that idea of Ireland and home and the farm, and then my life in New York, what that was kind of entailing, and to see them meet in that way was really special. So I actually sent Belinda the email, and she was like, this is so funny.
It sounds like you were haunting the proof pile.
Yeah, I was. Everyone else was like hanging outside the beauty department wanting free makeup. Stacks of books.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We'll be back to Louise soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, The Secret Countess by Eva Ibbotson. Some of Eva's books have recently been reissued by Pan Macmillan. Sarah Manning, a friend of YB, is a huge fan and has written the introduction for one of the books. The Secret Countess is the story of Anna, whose grand wealthy family have fled Russia during the revolution. They find themselves penniless in London.
Resourceful Anna gets a job as a maid at Mersham, an enormous country house, and she's working for the family of the Earl of Westerholme. Now, this book is a cure for every single 2020 feeling I've had. It's lavish, it's sumptuous, it's fun. It's proof that you can have characters who are gorgeously kind and lovable without being irritating. It's irreverent, it's weirdly, darkly funny, it's immensely satisfying, and it has priceless sapphires, a cream-filled giant meringue swan, and a fabulous subplot about some hotly anticipated dog poo. Reading Eva Ibbotson feels better than drinking champagne, than coming in from the cold on a rainy day, and then waiting for your pizza to arrive and hearing the ring of the doorbell. The Secret Countess by Eva Ibbotson is published by Pan Macmillan. It's out now. Now, back to Louise. So how did you end up on the fashion desk? And how did you get out of the fashion desk?
I don't know. But I obviously had done my undergrad in English, and then I did a postgraduate in fashion buying. A friend of mine in during that year had said, you know, there's this visa that you can do, that it's a J visa, where it has to be sort of the year after you graduate college, and that you can go and live in America for a year, and you have to intern. That's kind of part, you know, that's what the visa is based on. And I thought, oh, this sounds like a really amazing opportunity to go to a city that I really love, and spend a year there. And I started applying to like every fashion magazine that I could think of, because I really wanted to work in magazines. And it's so funny, like I remember thinking, I'm going to write handwritten letters because that'll really, you know, differentiate me from everybody else. And I never got any reply except for one in Glamour, who was this really lovely, lovely young woman. And she said, look, we can't hire you here because I think Condé Nast had been sued for having unpaid interns like a year previous. So she said, unless you can get college credit, we can't have you. But she said, my old boss at Elle is looking for people. And then she said, have you ever heard of Kate Lanfear? And I had pictures of Kate Lanfear on my wall at home. Like, it was so weird. It was just one of these really strange, serendipity of some kind. But I remember like the first week at Elle, they when they knew I was from Ireland, they said, oh my God, we got this really weird letter, like a handwritten letter from someone. And I was, oh my God. And I went bright red. And I remember my friend Angela said, that wasn't you, was it? And I was like, no, of course not. I mean, who would do such a thing? And they were like, yeah, my God, it was so embarrassing. We just had to throw it in the bin before. And I was like, okay.
I remember it was not anywhere near as glamorous as Elle in York. It was Bliss magazine in Kent in Tunbridge Wells.
Well, I'm sorry, now 15-year-old me thinks Bliss is very glam, so
I think why I was hired, because I, you know, mentally it's like Mariah Carey stopping at 12. I was 23 going on 15, but I was the intern, and then I hired the interns, or I booked the interns, and it's awful how quickly one becomes cynical and sort of seeing how hard people are trying, and you know, like it's Next Factor audition every day, and think, but I really just need you to sit quietly and transcribe this interview.
I remember, speaking of The Devil Wears Prada, when someone that I knew at Elle had emailed me, she was not my direct boss, but my boss's assistant. So she emailed me saying, you know, there's a job at Harper's Bazaar, and you know, I think you'd be really good for it. Will I put you up? And I emailed back and said, no, you know what, I've decided to stay at home. I'm writing a novel. And it was so funny because she didn't reply for ages, and then she replied, and you could just tell, like, she could tell she was quite anxious. And it was like, oh, a novel. Is it like, you know, The Devil Wears Prada? And I had to like be really, you know, sort of reassuring and say, no, it's not set in the fashion industry, I promise, you know. It's just set in a dystopian world where women starve themselves to please the male gaze. But no, nothing to do with fashion, don't worry.
Ever so slightly inspired by, but not so you'd recognise it. Amazing. I'm trying to think about other novels, books about jobs, and jobs that sound amazing and jobs that sound awful. And I was always very taken with the different jobs that all of the women have in The Girls of Slender Means. So Muriel Spark, and it's a a weird book, but she really captures that sense of being in your 20s and being ambitious, but there really being no room for any of that ambition, and just sort of hoping things will turn up, and kind of the strange, like, restless, fractious energy that doesn't have anywhere to go.
Do you ever find that with, just when you said Muriel Spark there, I thought, oh, that's another one of the authors that is on my list, that is one of those people that I haven't read any of her work, and is one of those people that I think I really must read this person. And Anne Tyler is another one of those. But actually, one person who was on my list, and I read my first one of her books at Christmas, and then binged like five of them in a row, was Anne Patchett.
Oh, really? That's so spooky, because I've had the proof of The Dutch House, and I had it for like over a year, and it had such a sort of imposing, impressive cover, and I really thought, oh, I think this is going to be quite like heavy and literary and dry, and everyone's raving about it, and I feel such a sense of duty and obligation to this book. And eventually I was like, look, I have to read it or give it away. Come on. And I loved it. I really loved it. And I'm just about to start reading. Is it Bel Canto?
Oh, yes. That is very good. Like, it really, again, quite a, do you know, even just the concept of it isn't exactly what you would think of as a quote unquote, like, literary novel. Do you know that they're like, she's quite plot driven. Do you know? Like, you know, even in the Dutch House and Commonwealth, and there's another book, and I'm trying to remember what it's called, and it's like, it's in the Amazon, like it's about medical experiments in the Amazon. I'm trying to think, do you remember the title of it?
I haven't read it, but I believe that comes up in Big Magic. Yes! You had this, and that's the book that Elizabeth Gilbert is trying to write.
Yeah, it's so strange.
That seems Catholic to me. That's some sort of like literary transubstantiation.
Yes, exactly.
I am going to get struck down, or what's the thing that happened to Madonna? Drummed out of the Catholic brownies.
Excommunicated. Yeah. I'm trying to think what the name of it is here. State of Wonder. I have, because I'm so bad at remembering books, I've actually this year have started writing a list of the books that I've read, just so that I can kind of prompt my memory. But it's really good. But it was fascinating because I read Big Magic. Liz Gilbert was talking about how if you have an idea, like the universe gives you an idea, and that you have to run with it, and you have to respect the fact that they've given you this idea, and that there's a limited, I suppose, window of time to develop this idea and work on it. So she has done all of the work on it, and then gets distracted, and then by the time she comes back to it, the energy's not there, and she starts another project. And then she meets Anne Patchett at an event, and Anne Patchett is telling her about her new book, State of Wonder, and there's these, like, it's actually quite spooky, actually, I think, because it's such a specific type of book, like the plot is very specific, so it's not something like, oh, you know, my character meets an older man and they have an affair, you're like, okay.
And it's not just that it's set in South America, it's the geography and like the industry they're in, and
exactly. So she thinks that they hugged on an event, and she thinks that she sort of transferred the idea over to Anne Patchett, which is the kind of thing that when writers talk about, that people who aren't writers say, okay, the crazy talk here again. But I think there's something about creativity that does, I don't know, I suppose it does allow you to believe in a magic of sort, because when you have created something out of nothing, you know, when you have sat at your computer and looked at a blank page and have made a world and have made characters to populate it and have developed a story, and then all of a sudden it's a book and you have no idea, like you take that leap of faith and you know you hope the net will appear. I think that when you do that, there is a part of you that has to believe in magic, because the act of creativity is so just impossible to explain, impossible to define. when it's going well, sometimes it can feel as if you're dictating, like someone's, you're taking dictation, that you're almost channeling it in some sort of strange way. So I think that when you hear about something like that, as far-fetched as it sounds, there's a part of you that I don't know, feels like it's as good as a reason or an explanation as any, because it's so difficult to define creativity itself.
Where does any idea come from? So I have just read Dolly Alderton's debut novel, Ghosts, which is coming out next October. It is excellent. And she has just read mine, Insatiable, which is coming out in February.
It's also excellent. Hey, shut up, you're addressing me.
There are lines in both books that are weirdly similar. My heroine, Violet, says something like, "I wish I had a condom for my heart." And then Nina, Dolly's heroine, says of her best friend, "I wish I could give her a condom for her heart." And Dolly sent me a WhatsApp saying, "I know this looks bad." You say that, your book comes out first.
I know.
And others, and we're both very aware of, I think, having lots of friends who write. And obviously, part of it is as well, we're of a similar experience and generation, and there will be things that we've just absorbed and internalised, and, you know, dumb jokes and TV shows and weird, like, news things and everything that's, you know, that shape people. There's going to be a lot of that sort of commonality in the air.
Oh, 100%. And I think if you gave the same idea to 10 people, they would write it in 10 entirely different ways. And I think, you know, a lot of it, I think, is this idea of collective consciousness. And we are all, as you say, consuming the same media. But often I think we're connected to each other in ways that we don't even really understand. And I also think, like, I remember when Lucy Foley's proof of her new novel was sent to me, and I actually got such a fright when I heard the blurb, because it was so similar to mine in that it was an island, a wild party, a storm, and then a body is found the next day. And I was like, oh Jesus. And especially as that thing of hers is coming out in February and mine is coming out in September, you know, Christ. But I think then when you look at it, like, there's such different books, you know, that, like, hers is like an Agatha Christie style murder mystery, and it's very much like a closed room narrative, but also entirely focused on, like, that event and, you know, the kind of almost like a weekend. Whereas mine is, you know, like 10 years later, you know, after this murder has happened, that this true crime podcast is being made about the murder. And it's much more, I think, I suppose, to do with the trauma and the grief and the way in which this very small, tightly knit community have been torn apart by that. So I think it's, even though an idea might sound ostensibly almost identical, that the way in which two writers who have very different sensibilities and styles, and also different themes or motifs that interest them or what they're working out, and, you know, on the page, and those will result in totally different novels.
I'd love to have a go at rewriting Carrie.
Oh, that would be amazing.
But obviously, I love Carrie. I think it's a, you know, fantastic book, but something like maybe first person with a lot less of a focus on the telekinesis and just about her isolation and vulnerability and her relationship with her mother.
Oh, you have to write this. This is going to be your next YA novel, like your YA debut. It's going to be this now.
Oh, that, well, I can get permission from the estate.
Yeah, it might be easier, yeah, to choose an older book.
But we had Curtis Sittenfeld on the podcast, and she was talking about Eligible, which I didn't know this, but I think she was approached with that idea. And obviously, the great thing about that is it's sort of, I think, I'm assuming it's out of copyright. I'd have to check that. But in terms of
it definitely is.
The estate, yeah, and how that works, it's got to be much easier. But also, once the what is down and established, and you can just work out the why. Because you've written a retelling of The Little Mermaid.
I was just going to say there, firstly, that the best Austen adaptation is Clueless, and I will fight anyone who disagrees with that. It's so funny. The first time I saw Clueless, I had read Emma maybe a year before, and I kept thinking, God, this is so like Emma. And, You know what? I suppose when you're that age, you think it's like an original thought that you've had because you're not on the internet, so you're not reading articles
There's
about
an
it.
Elton and then Mr. Elton. I mean, what kind of crazy coincidence is that?
I know. It took me, I'd say I was like 20 before someone, you know, said, oh, that was a retail. And I was like, oh my God, it all makes sense now. The Surface Breaks, which was my fourth novel, was a feminist retelling of The Little Mermaid. And actually it was a really interesting experience because like I had, you know, at the start, I suppose my publisher, my editor had given me a lot of freedom in saying, you know, you can interpret this or reinterpret this in whatever way you want. And I actually think I made a decision to hew more closely to the original story because while, you know, updating it and I suppose making it my own, because I think that an issue with a lot of these fairy tales is that people don't realize how dark, you know, particularly the original versions are, because the memories that they have are maybe of the Disney version and, you know, that kind of very clean cut, whitewashed reinterpretation. And I think that for me, it was like wanting to show that so often the stories that we tell our children, we tell them without really consciously thinking about those stories or the messages that the children are going to internalize as a result, because they're seen as classics, or because they're seen as, you know, well, I read them when I was a child and my mother read them when, you know, when she was a child. And a lot of the time there's quite harmful messages, I think, in fairy tales. So it was trying to, I suppose, highlight those in a way. I really enjoyed it. I think actually what I enjoyed is that, you know, at the moment I've just started work on a new project, and it's trying to, like, it's really exhausting at the beginning because you're trying to figure out who these characters are and you're trying to make sense of the world and you're trying to almost find your feet in it. And that is actually, I think, quite mentally draining. I swear I was down a mine, but like it can be quite draining. And I think that what I loved about the retelling was that you have, I suppose, a certain outline. You know, I knew, okay, it's going to be her 15th birthday, she's going to meet the sea witch, you know, she's going to go take the potion, go to land. So there were these, I suppose, plot points that I wanted to hit. And then I was allowed, or I suppose I gave myself permission to really experiment and I suppose enjoy the process in between. But I imagine it will be like if you're writing a series, you know, in a way that like the first book and then by the second book, you're kind of, you're hitting the ground running because you have this world set up and you know who these characters
you're
are.
You're not using up all that energy thinking, well, how would this, yeah. You sort of know, you get to know someone well enough to know how they're going to react in a given situation. And I think that's, when you've got no constraints or say boundaries, it's so hard to know what it is that you're establishing. Do you feel it out as you write, or do you start by kind of just asking yourself questions and making notes?
I think with the first book, with Only Ever Yours, I probably just sat down and started writing. But definitely since then, I have tried to really have a very strong sense of the characters and who they are. Because as you said, it does make that a little bit easier as the book continues when you have an understanding of their motivations, why they behave the way that they do, how they would behave under certain circumstances, you know, all of those things. So I do, I think, more planning now, actually. The more books I write, I think the easier I find it to do the planning at this end, because otherwise I think sometimes you can hit roadblocks midway through and you're trying to figure it out. I mean, with After the Silence, which is the new one, I think that I probably have never done as much research and as much planning. I did around 6 months, and that would be very unusual for me. But just, you know, I wanted to talk to people who grew up on islands off the coast of Ireland and get a sense of that. It deals with coercive control, so I was doing a lot of research talking to survivors and just things like, you know, there's an unsolved murder at the heart of it, and talking to policemen and talking to an investigative journalist, and I even talked to the state pathologist, the former state pathologist, because I really just wanted to say, would this happen? How, like, if this happened, what would the next step be? And it was a lot of work, but I think that, I mean, hopefully, you know, it paid off in the end.
I'm so excited to read it. I can't wait. I can imagine if be it, and I'm sure this is, you know, never be the case, but thinking about what it'd be like as a writer and be like, I want to make sure this is an unsolved murder, because I read so little in the way of like of crime thrillers that I feel like anything that I'd come up with half I solved this by page 35.
I think it's funny, I would have very rarely read crime, and because my dad loves it and my sister enjoys it as well. I am a big scaredy cat, and I hate like suspense, I hate not knowing, like I hate feeling anxious, you know, when I'm reading a book. And you know, it was interesting, a friend said to me a few years ago, we were talking about crime and she was trying to get me to read more psychological thrillers, and I said, I don't know if it's really for me, and she made this amazing point, and she said that the bad writers in this genre, she said, use women and women's bodies as tropes or as like a narrative device, and she said the good writers actually are using this genre to interrogate why women feel afraid and what it's like to, I think, navigate the world in a female body. And when she said that, you know, and she recommended people, you know, she recommended Megan Abbott and she recommended Erin Kelly, Tana French, Leanne Moriarty. And I think it was really, I think, seeing work by these incredible female writers who were doing the latter, I think, and doing it just spectacularly well, actually, that I think really was a great introduction to this genre. And also, I think, challenged a lot of the assumptions that maybe that I had had about it before starting to read those books.
That's a really interesting point. And I've loved Erin Kelly whenever I've read her. And everyone else you mentioned, I'm like, yeah, I feel like I would like those writers very much. I suppose going back to what you were saying about Sweet Valley High, now more than ever being like, what I want is angel delight in a book form. But then sometimes there is something really powerful about scaring yourself and understanding. My friend Caroline Corin has got a new book out called The Baby Group, and her book before that was excellent, Through the Wall. And they're both in that family, I think, of having really compelling, interesting women at their heart. Leanne Moriarty, everyone I know loves her. I really must read that and prepare to be a little scared, but in a smart way.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I started writing After the Silence, I think I wanted it to be like primarily a psychological thriller, but also sort of sneak in a bit of feminism. I just thought, you know, just get it in there. I think
you and your feminism, Louise.
I know, I can't help it. I can't help myself. But I think Leanne Moriarty does that really well, particularly in Big Little Lies, obviously, which, you know, is at its heart a whodunit. But there's such an incredible exploration of domestic violence and this very complicated, very like sexual relationship and very tempestuous and very passionate. And you can see, I suppose, how confusing that is, you know, for the woman at the heart of it and how she almost, I suppose, believes herself to be complicit in it. It's just very, it's very skillfully done.
Oh, I've got so much to read now. I can't wait.
I'm sorry.
Huge thanks to Louise. After the Silence is out now, and I think we're going to be seeing on a lot of Book of the Year lists. Go forth and read. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska, and it's hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at Why Booked. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would make me so happy if you left us a 5-star review. It's the best way to help new listeners to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this from Jerry Seinfeld. A bookstore is one of the only pieces of evidence we have that people are still thinking. See you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.